It's 4 o'clock on a Monday, and you know what that means, don't you? It's time for another exciting episode of Taxi TV Live. Woohoo! Hello, everybody, and let's say welcome to our very special guest, Miss Robin Frederick. And before we go any further, I want to remind you that Robin is the author of Shortcuts to Hit Songwriting, which is a best-selling book. She's also the author of Shortcuts to Songwriting for Film and Television, but we're not going there today because today's episode is... Oh, let me get back to me. Today's episode is all about how to avoid the five mistakes that new songwriters make. And the reason we're doing this episode is that I get emails, you know, a couple, three a month, from songwriters who are just beginning their journey. And they often say to me, hey, Michael, I've watched the stuff that you do with Robin on your channel, and it's great. But I feel like you guys are talking to like level, college level 201s and 301 classes. I'm just starting out. I want to know, how do I start? What mistakes might I make? So that's what we're going to talk about today. So if you've never written a song before, this is especially for you. And I'm sure that those of you who have written some and are even more experienced are going to learn some stuff today anyway. So thanks for joining us. And with that, I give you once again, Miss Robin Frederick. And the crowd goes wild.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Good.
So yeah, where do you want to start?
You know what? I think when people are starting the business, and I'm thinking back to when I started in the business too, because we all come in with the same misconceptions and the same mythologies about the music business. And I think one of the things, as you're writing your first songs, one of the things, you know, you have these things in the back of your mind, and you may be, it may be keeping you from becoming better, faster, successful, sooner.
Oh, you know? Shoot. Let me, yeah. My email's still open. Let me kill that real quick. I'm sorry. All right, continue, please.
Okay. And so you want to get rid of some of that junk that's in your head that you've heard for a long time, or you imagine that you've heard it, and it's keeping you from writing the kinds of songs you want to write and the kinds of songs that would be successful for you in the music business. Because those two things really do go together. One of the things I noticed right away, and I had it too for years, and I hear other people, I hear all kinds of songwriters say this, which is they're thinking that success in the music industry is like the lottery. You just write as much as you can and throw it at the wall and see what sticks. Or you buy a lot of, you know, you spend some money and you buy a lot of basically tickets, you know, write a lot of songs and you hope that one of them is gonna hit. Somebody's gonna hear it and go, oh my God, that's the best thing I've ever heard. I'm gonna use it in my TV show or I'm gonna put it on my album, right? So the truth is the music business is much more, in some ways, rational than that. It actually is something you can and should approach with the mindset that this is a career. I'm starting to write songs now, and I want these songs eventually to be used in this business, and I want them to pay me money in this business, and I also want to be proud of them. I want it to be something that I feel strongly about, that I feel is good. So whether you're going to be the artist, whether you're a singer-songwriter, or whether you're writing songs to pitch to artists, or whether you're writing songs to pitch to film and television, it's all about the use that these various markets have for the songs you're writing. So if you give them a song that isn't something they can use, no matter how good it is, they'll turn it down. And you'll end up feeling, if you don't understand that, you'll end up feeling, oh, my song isn't good. But your song is good.
Oh, I'm so glad you're saying this. Keep going. This is gold.
I was just working with somebody today, and she had written a song that expressed what was in her heart, and it's a beautiful song, but it's dated, and it's dated, it feels old-fashioned. In other words, it's a song that will be difficult to get into the industry because most of the sections of the industry like contemporary sounding songs and artists. Those are the things they know they can sell. Those are the things they know where the fans are, and they can reach the fans of other contemporary artists, which is a lot of what they do. Mm-hmm. So we talked about it, and I could see she was starting to feel deflated because we were saying, well, you'd have to fix this and you might need to do that and the production. And we were starting to go there. And I could see how hard that was for her to hear after a while. And I said, look, stop. it's a beautiful song, which it is. It's a beautiful song. And maybe it will find a home. But let's keep working. Let's start new songs. Let's move forward. Keep this one for those uses that you might find for it. But if it doesn't, if it isn't going to fit the use that you have in your mind now, because she wrote the song before, I mean, the song is not something she wrote last week with a use in mind, then just keep going forward. Don't stop. Don't stop. Just
and she might learning. Pick up some new skills. She probably will she pick will. Up new skills, new techniques. Oh, yeah. And someday she may go, oh, now I hear what Robin heard, why that is so dated, and go back and try and freshen it up. So, yeah.
She could. You could put it on the back burner, come back later. But to sit there and hammer away at it and chip away at it when you don't know the you know, the tricks of making things sound a little more contemporary, you're just going to destroy your song. And I would hate to see that because it's a beautiful song. I love it. I mean, people, taxi members play things, you know, they submit things. And one of the hardest things I had to do when I was a taxi screener was return a song, a good song, because it was too dated for the listing. And I had to say, and I meant it, whenever I said it, I meant it. This could have been a hit in 1975. This could have been a hit for Seals and Crofts. Could have, you know, this is a beautiful song, but it will have trouble finding a home now because it isn't current.
You just gave me a great idea for an episode. Someday, let's do an episode where we play songs that people have submitted and you and I guess their age based on what they've written, because and not to be cruel about it, but it is kind of a dead giveaway. Yeah, I grew up with James Taylor, Neil Young, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, the Eagles. If I wrote songs, they would probably harken back to that general vibe. And I think that would be a fun thing to do. And the person that we get the farthest away from guessing their age gets a free copy of the book or something.
There is a new research. I've just been researching this myself because my newsletter is going to be about this. There is something called the reminiscence bump. And between the ages of 12 and 22, when we are our emotions are at their peak, after age 22, your emotions kind of start to settle down a little bit. But as a teenager, your emotions and hormones are on full throttle. 12 to 22, the music, the songs that we hear, have the most influence on our emotions because we're emotional. And so that imprints more deeply because the songs, because songs express emotion. It imprints more deeply at that age. And so they're looking for an answer to why that is. You've said this for years. I've heard you say it, and I totally agree with it. And there's a reason for it. It's because we were the most open to the emotional impact of songs during that period. So we kind of have to work at it a little harder now. And so when people say to me, I'm going to talk about this a little bit later. When people say to me, I don't like anything on the radio. Music today is terrible. It's not the Beatles. It's not Oasis. It's not, you know, whoever was a hip.
It's not what I grew up loving.
It's not what I grew up with. Yeah. And there's a real psychological and neurological reason for that. So we need to work at that to change that. If you really want to do this like a career, you need to know what it is the music industry is asking for.
I would add one more thing to why that happens, and maybe they mentioned it, which is between the ages of 12 and 22, you're not that employed. You may have some employment. You may be a lifeguard at 15 at the, you know, at the county pool for the summer. At 18, maybe you're, you know, working at a restaurant or whatever, but you have more time. And back in our day, we didn't have a phone with the entire world sitting on it at our fingertip. So what did we do? We hung out in our dorm room or our apartment or our bedroom at our parents' house. Music was our friend. That was our escape. That was our way of, it was a part of the maturation process. It's something that we had that was our own. Our parents didn't take us to the park to play. We discovered music. We discovered artists we liked, songs that we loved. And we totally absorb that into our very being. I think probably less of that happens today because of that little evil thing. But still, you see a lot of kids growing up loving music, and that's because they've got the time to fall in love.
And it's part of your life. It's absolutely. And when you're young, it's part of your life. It speaks to your emotions, directly to your emotions. And it says things to your emotions that you don't hear anybody else say. Your friends might say them. But if you've got a broken heart and you've got a song that speaks to you from a, you know, with a voice that you identify with or relate to, you're going to feel that song more deeply than anything else in your life because it's talking to you about what's happening to you. It's music has incredible power to communicate emotion with people. And I want to talk about some more about that because that's such an important part of what new songwriters often don't understand is the emotion of music, the emotional impact of, that music has.
Sorry, there's a garbage truck working outside my office window. I don't know if you can hear that.
Just barely.
If I can interject a little thing mm-hmm. about emotion, it's a great little story. Back in the very first 6 months of my career, I worked at Criteria Studios in Miami. The Bee Gees were there recording. And we would all see each other in the hallway at the coffee machine, water fountain, men's room, whatever, multiple times a day. So I would see Barry, all three of the brothers Gibb, but Barry in particular was maybe the most gregarious and nicest guy in the world. Yeah. And one day I asked him, I said, how do you write, what makes a song a hit? And he looked at me, bemused, I guess would be the best word, like you don't know this already. But yeah, I was like, I'm just starting out. And he looks at me, he goes, emotion, mate. Emotion, and he walked away. So there
Let
you
me,
go.
I've got a quote that I'm going to read about this, about exactly what you were just saying about the emotion, I put it into the context of, okay, so new songwriters. Let's say you're not, you know, you're a new songwriter, but you're not 22. You're a new songwriter, but you're 50 or 60. You've come back to it after your years of being in the career, and you want to get back into it again. And yet I hear so many people say to me, hit songs today, they're just successful because the record label paid to have them played a lot. Okay. Number one, that would be a horrible business model, is to play a song that annoys people over and over and over, you know, it's going to annoy them more. That's not going to work. And you'd never stay in business. I don't think the record labels are the sharpest people on the planet, but they're not that dumb. And, so it'd be a ridiculous business model. And with YouTube and TikTok out there, listeners are voting with their ears. I mean, yeah. They are. So you don't even have to guess what you want to promote because listeners are telling you what they like. And so the record labels are following suit.
Yeah, and it's always been that way, even before the internet or any sort of real-time voting. I mean, they did surveys. You're right. They may have pushed something that would have annoyed us, but somebody, a big part of the market, liked it enough that they promoted it because they saw it smoking and they poured gasoline on it to make it a fire.
That well said, well said. So here's a quote from Jason Flom. And Jason Flom, the former CEO of Atlantic, and he ran Virgin Records and he ran Capitol Music Group and he founded Lava Records, really successful. From an indie startup became an enormously successful label. Yeah. Jason Flom says, he says, a hit song is a song that people react to. People only buy songs that they like, and you can't force them to like anything. It's emotional. It's the emotion, man. It really is. It's what grabs people. It's what moves people. They will want to hear again. And it's got to genuinely touch their emotions. You can't fake that. You have to actually be there and be real in your song in order to reach people. So it's exactly the opposite of that myth that people have about the music business, which is this is all fake, this is all inauthentic. It's not. There may be songs you don't relate to or you don't like. That's fine. There's a lot of people in this world who like different things. But there are going to be songs out there if you look for them. There are songs now, just as there were when we were growing up. There are wonderful songs out there.
And you know what? I've been running Taxi now for 32 years, and something that I hear all the time from people, they equate A&R people or publishers or Taxi's A&R staff as gatekeepers that want to keep you out. They think that people are trying to keep you out. They're not. People are desperately looking for hits because that's how they keep their job and they make money for the company. I guess make money for the company and then keep their job.
Right. And a hit is a song that reaches a lot of people emotionally.
Yeah.
So that's what they're looking for. Yes. And in Kate, and I just want to mention, as far as A&R people, I was head of production in A&R for a division of Rhino Records. And the A&R guys on the same floor with me, we all had offices next to each other, these guys were all music nuts.
Yeah.
I mean, you could ask them anything, any obscure thing, and five guys would fall out of their offices with the right answer.
Right.
They love music more than anything in the world. And there are taxi screeners just like those guys, too. You have some wonderful screeners who have that ability. They know everything that's being played on the radio, I swear, encyclopedic knowledge, and love for the music industry, because they wouldn't really be in it otherwise. It's a pretty tough industry, no matter which side of the desk you're sitting on. And they love music and they want to be around it. They, like you just said, they want to find hits. It's part of their job. Yeah. They need to find good artists that people will react to and respond to. And yes, they need to sell, but hit records are ones that people like. And so if they like it, they'll buy it. And that's where the money stream comes from. And it's all circular. You have to appeal to the listener. That's where you're headed. Record companies will follow. They follow the listeners. They aren't making it happen.
Yeah. I mean, for the last 25 years, at least, they have people that do nothing but research to see what is smoldering in a small market. Mm-hmm. Is somebody, you know, really big in Peoria, Illinois?
Nirvana in Seattle.
Yeah.
How did they find the Seattle scene just exploded?
Yep. So they look for what's taking off somewhere, and proportionately, you know, while selling 30,000 records in New York City is no big deal, in Seattle it might be. So then they say, well, would that band from Seattle, or would that song, either or, take off in a bigger market? And they'll test it in the next level of market size, and then after that go to a bigger one, and then go wide all over the country if it continues to do well. But it's always emotion that drives it. If people don't feel it, and feel like it's talking to them about their life or some shared experience,
they won't buy it. Yeah, they won't. They won't listen to it again. They won't click on it. It's so easy now to just, click, change it, click, change it. No, I don't like that. I mean, if they even get through the first verse, I'll be shocked. Intros are so important now because they're like the welcome mat that says, "Do you want to come in? You know, you want to come in here? Come in to hear my song."
But they are shorter, aren't they?
They are short, yeah. You can start a vocal right at the top because the vocal is the welcome mat.
Yeah.
The vocal, the sound of the voice is a welcome mat. Anything that makes people interested, intrigued, and for film and television, intros are still quite long, but they really want to get to the voice. People are really vocal-centric now, and it doesn't need to be a voice like Adele. It needs to be a voice with authenticity and character. So a lot of people who say to me, oh, I can't sing, I'll have to hire a singer. And that keeps me from finishing my songs because I can't afford to hire a singer. And I listen to their voice and they've got a sense of real person talking to you. It connects with me. And if it connects with me, it's going to connect with other people. And
they
They
have to know that about themselves, though. Some people may think they're better than they are, and some people might think that they're not as good as they are. But you're right about the authenticity. I mean, frankly, I don't think Taylor Swift is a great vocalist. She's not an Adele, but she's very authentic and right for her songs. And by the way, I'm thinking about doing a co-write with Taylor called Catch That Ball, Travis.
Now.
Yeah.
Right.
You know better boyfriend, right, Travis?
Yes, I do. Okay. Yes. And I'm going to talk about Cruel Summer in a little bit, the hit that she has right now. Tom Petty. Excuse me, Tom Petty he hits the note somewhere in there and then he falls right off it. But you believe him when he sings Refugee.
Yeah.
You believe that he's feeling it. And so some voices don't really have that and some people don't know how to express that. But I do tell people who don't think they can sing but might be able to sing perfectly well for film and television or roots rock, something like that, I tell them, take some acting classes. Learn how to commit to what it is you're singing and get it across to people because, boy, you can get away with a lot in terms of pitch, in terms of control. There's some things you can't really get away with, but at a certain point, if you have intent in your voice, if you're thinking about what you're singing and you're feeling it, you overcome a lot of stuff, like a lot of pitch problems. I know I do. I've been assigned artist twice, they wouldn't even let me in the glee club in high school.
At Neil Young. I think one of the most authentic vocals that comes to mind quickly for me is Old Man by Neil Young on the Harvest album.
Yeah.
I mean, he is singing it right to that guy, and you become the old man he's singing it to every time you hear it. But if you listen to that vocal on a technical level, he's not a singer. On a delivering the song to your heart level, he nails it. Right in the bullseye.
Yeah.
So let's hit another. I feel like we've gone a little bit off the reservation. Great information.
Talking about singing, I know. Yeah. But I was glad we did, because this is one of those things that stops people from writing in their tracks when it comes to production. I can't sing it. I can't afford it. I don't know any singers who can do it. I get stuck. I stop. I put my song aside. Don't finish it. So I was glad we were talking about it.
If I may add one more thing to that.
Yes, please.
I'm going to throw in a little taxi plug here, but not gratuitously. And that is on our forum at forums.taxi.com. We have Collaboration Corner. So if you happen to be a really strong top liner that can write a great melody and a great lyric, or even if you're an up-and-comer that's learning how to do that, and you don't have any skills, you know, with recording or production, put that on the taxi forum. It's free to join, and you can say, hey, I'm you know, a budding top writer that seems to be doing pretty well, but I have no production skills and no studio chops. Anybody want to team up with me? We've created a lot of marriages, for lack of a better description, that have become successful duos doing that. So there's always an answer if you really want it.
I've recommended a lot of people go to the forum looking for collaborators in various kinds. And also, if maybe if you're looking for a singer, you might find a good singer there as well. So very useful resource there that people, it's underused, I know it is. Okay, how about, this is one I've noticed quite a bit, thinking that using Songcraft will make you sound like everyone else and you'll lose your originality.
Oh, formulaic. I don't want to be formulaic.
Formula songwriting. Yes, formula songwriting. Some people have said to me, what do you mean formula songwriting? But it's a very common phrase. And it means writing using the common song structure with a big chorus or the, you know, verse, pre-chorus, chorus, and, you know, having a strong hook. Those kinds of things that get you something that sounds vaguely like a radio hit. And the idea that you'll become less original is the fear there. If I use Songcraft, I will sound like everyone else. So there's a couple of ways to approach that. If you understand why we use song structure, then you can use it in a way that makes sense to you. You can play with it. You can be creative with it. It will never sound like anybody else. I mean, so many songs have the same structure and they don't sound anything alike, that it can't be that if you use just structure, you're going to end up sounding like other people. So for example, if you are using, for your chorus, let's say you've got a chorus and you go up in the pitch range, which we generally do for big choruses, you know, is that going to sound like everybody else's big hit song chorus? Well, it's not a bad thing to sound like a hit song, number one.
No, I think it's quite a good thing.
Go ahead and do that, yeah. So if you notice that a lot of songs you like are doing that, you might want to do that, but you want to do it in your own way. So you can be creative with that if you understand why we do it. The reason we go up, I think this is my reason why I think we go up for the chorus, is because choruses are the most emotional part of the song. Right? In the verse, we're giving information, but the chorus is, this is where my heart is, this is how I feel. And our voices tend to rise as we get more emotional. If I get excited, my voice goes up. If I get angry, my voice goes up. If it gets louder and it goes up. And so choruses for a long time have tended to get higher and the production gets bigger and the song gets a little bit louder. There's real emotional reasons for doing that. And if you understand that, then you can write choruses and say, oh, I get it. They make sense. That feels comfortable to me. If you don't want to do that, you can make the choice not to do it, but you still have to do something to replace it, because we use contrast in songs between the verse and chorus so that listeners know where they are. Am I in the verse? Am I in the chorus? Oh, I recognize that. I like that. I want to hear that verse. They're expecting another chorus after that. How are they going to know they're in the chorus if there's no clear contrast between verse and chorus melody? So if you take a look at R&B songs now, and for a long time, R&B songs, they're too cool for the big chorus. They don't like the big emotional chorus.
We're so true.
Yeah. And so they change pace. The verse may be very, very chatty, but then the chorus kind of smooths out and they hit all the downbeats and there's not a lot of syncopation in the chorus. Or they may do the opposite. They may have smooth verses and then really get choppy in that chorus. So it's contrast in pace. It can be contrast in note rhythm patterns. Just listen and you'll hear the patterns change. In the verse, I'm using mainly da, 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 and repeat that. And then repeat it again. Mm-hmm. Then you go to the chorus, and all of a sudden you sing ba da ba da da ba 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 da ba ba ba. It just totally changed the rhythm pattern, and that creates lots of contrast. And you didn't have to go up in the note range if you didn't want to. So there's lots of solutions out there to that problem.
You have played a song that's a piano vocal song. It was a huge hit, probably 4 or 5
Lewis
years ago.
Louis Capaldi.
What's the name of the song?
Someone You Loved. Someone You Loved.
And that's a great example of just enough contrast, even though it's piano vocal.
It went to number one.
Yeah.
And it was number one for a long time, too. Someone You Loved is a song probably everybody listening to this knows, watching this, is familiar with. Louis Capaldi, Someone You Loved. If you don't know it, go listen to it, and you will hear him do a lot of repetition of note patterns. That's the verse.
Yeah.
Then he goes to the chorus and he does different rhythm patterns that he then repeats in the chorus. And so you know which section you're in. Without a doubt, you know what section you're in.
Right.
And
without a full band production behind it, which is often part of the cue that you're in the chorus because it's bigger or different. But he does it with just piano vocal.
Right. There's a lot of really creative songwriting going on there out there with just the structure of songs. You can listen to Dermot Kennedy, Outnumbered, and you'll hear him put in a rap kind of, he's a singer-songwriter, but he puts a rap section into a song, and I don't even know what to call that. Ed Sheeran does the same thing. He's got 4 sections in Thinking Out Loud. I don't know what those 2 middle sections are. One is a pre-chorus, I think. And yet it makes sense. It holds together. So if you're interested in fooling around with structure, you can go listen to songs that are recent hits or recently successful, and you can find all kinds of ways, different ways to do something with songcraft. You're not locked into it. It's
I've
just
got
that
a question, though.
Want it.
The Ed Sheeran example is a great example of somebody breaking the rules, but they knew the rules first before they broke them. And so this is a mistake that I'm throwing out that new songwriters make, which is, I'm going to do something totally different. I'm going to change the industry. I'm going to be the next Beatles. And you know what? Ed Sheeran can do that because he's Ed Sheeran. He's earned the right and he's developed the underlying craft. The foundation of songwriting gives him the craft he needs to break those rules in a way that's commercially viable and very appealing and touches your emotion. So I'm saying to any new songwriters watching this, because I've been in the business for 49 years, if you really don't know what you're doing all that well yet, and you try and do all this crazy stuff, and you think, oh, everybody's going to think I'm a genius, creative genius. No, you can't be Picasso unless you actually learn how to paint first. So,
You're absolutely right. And learn the craft, then you can break the rules. But also, I do want to point out, because you just said something, I didn't even have it on my list, and you're so right. It's just such a really important basic thing. I'm going to be a total original. I'm going to reinvent songwriting and just blow everybody's mind. It is so completely rare. I don't even know if we ever hear something that isn't built on something that went before. And people will often use the Beatles as an example of originality, but they weren't.
Right.
I had their first album, Meet the Beatles, and the very last song on it was Till There Was You from the Music Man. Yeah. Paul McCartney loved the American Songbook. And you see the structure of the American Songbook in all of those early Beatles songs. And John Lennon loved the raw, raucous Chuck Berry rock and roll. And they put them together. They fused them. It was a blend. It was a blend that no one had done before successfully. But they did it. So it wasn't original. It was a blend of two pre-existing things. So if you're going to be, if you do want to like set the music industry on its ear and come up with something completely new, I would say stand on the shoulders of giants and go back and pull out the things you love and then look forward and maybe blend those with something now. That's what Bruno Mars is doing, basically. He's taking the Police and he's taking the Delphonics and he's taking all these different things. And as Silk Sonic, he and Anderson .Paak have created this thing that draws on the Delphonics and other artists of the late 60s and early 70s. And then they blend them with contemporary drum patterns and synth, the use of synth and the use of electric guitars the way we do now, and blends in harmony, and of course the beautiful mixes we have now. And it's different, and it appeals to people. It's a blend. It's original, but it's a blend. So that's something, I'm glad you brought it up.
I want to, this harkens back to what you talked about as soon as we started today, which is, I think one of the big mistakes is people don't listen to contemporary music. You mentioned that they'll say, oh, I hate what's on radio today. Well, okay, go ahead. Hate what's on radio. Go to Spotify and search like a top 40 or top 100 playlist on Spotify. Even if you don't love it, if you can tolerate it, listen to it over and over and over again, because by osmosis, those drum patterns that you were just talking about, or things that make a melody fresher, more contemporary, those things do seep into your consciousness. Mm-hmm. It wouldn't hurt to take some notes about it and try and figure out what they're doing, but if nothing else, just by listening. I mean, if you walk through a museum of contemporary art every day, you know, 365 days for a year, you're going to be much better positioned to paint contemporary art than somebody who doesn't. So...
Yeah. That's true. You're right about that. It's very true. I do tell people, look for what you do like and study that, because you are going to listen to it a lot. Pull it apart, reverse engineer it. You can let it seep in, which it does do, and you can speed up that process of having it seep in by studying it and pulling it apart. And I reverse engineer hit songs all the time, and I always look for songs that I like. I look on Spotify, I find one thing I like, and then I can go down that rabbit hole. Mm-hmm. I can let Spotify suggest more, or I can go over to Pandora and let Pandora or Napster suggest more like this. And eventually, it's sometimes I look at the charts. I go look at the country charts, the rock charts, the adult contemporary charts. You can find them now at iHeartRadio Music Charts. Just you look at that on, do a search for that on Google, and you'll find the current charts. Mm-hmm. Go listen to whatever's on the rock charts or country or adult contemporary, anything that you're interested in. I also get the college radio charts because those are interesting to me. But I have to go through a lot of stuff sometimes before I find things that I like and that I want to study. And then look at what they're doing with lyrics, with melody, with chord progression. Try to play and sing or sing along with it for a verse and chorus to get the feel in your body. Once it's a body thing. Songwriting is physical. It isn't mental. It's physical. Mm-hmm. And if you don't get the feel of the groove and the feel of the way the lyrics feel in your mouth when you sing them to that melody, it's going to be harder for you to write things that are singable. It'll be harder to write songs that feel right, that feel good. So that's how I would treat looking for something that you do like, that you do want to write like.
That is current. Don't fall back to the James Taylor playlist. Yeah. Love James Taylor, but you don't want to write.
Right, because you already have that embedded. Yeah. If you want to do a blend, you're going to want to get some of the contemporary stuff or look for a collaborator who's got the contemporary chops to blend what you already know. It's good to know the old stuff. It's great. You want to also try know the new stuff as well as you can. But there are times when you have to work outside your comfort zone. And so let's say, for example, you have a collaborator you really like to work with, and the collaborator has gotten hold of a music brief for a club dance song. And club dance is generally, it's for playing in the clubs, people to get sweaty out on the dance floor and, you know, dance all night and drink a lot. So it doesn't feature a lot of lyrics, and it may not, you may hate it actually. I don't, but you might. And, but the payout for this music brief is like $10,000. So you really want to do it, and your collaborator really wants to do it. So you say yes. Okay, so then you kind of do this other thing where you go looking at that genre and you listen to it and listen to the hits, the current hits in that genre, and you reverse engineer those. Look at what the lyrics are doing. What's the melody doing? How is the chords working on that? And you look at what's good in that genre that you might want to do. Okay, so Dua Lipa, great lyrics, great melodies in that genre. Ed Sheeran's in that genre now. Miley Cyrus, Flowers, giant international global hit in that genre. And so there's three right there that you could sit down with and learn from. Let them be a masterclass for you. Then you can come back to your co-writer and say, yeah, okay, I can do this, and I'm going to do a good job of it. We're not going to do something that you hate. Because right. You can't write a song that you hate, right? I've talked about this before. You can't write a song you don't like, because how do you know when it's done? When you don't like it enough. I hate that song. Ah, it's done. There we go. You can't. Every choice you make as you write a song has to be a choice that you say, that feels right to me. That's what I want to say. Yes, that feels good. Let's do that. You can never write something and say, oh, I hate that. Okay, that's the choice I'll make. Because it'll make the song bad enough to be on the radio or whatever.
But don't use it as a parachute to bail out early either, because I think some, especially newer songwriters who haven't learned the lesson of persistence actually does work, will bail on something early because, I don't like the way this is going. I'm moving on. When actually, no, you just have a speed bump or a problem or something to solve. And that's where the craft that you're going to learn with every mistake, every failure makes you stronger. You know, the old adage, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Well, the same is true in songwriting, I believe. I found that to be true in producing, which is if I made a mistake and I was adult enough to recognize my mistake, then next time I wouldn't make that mistake again, and I would actually think through what should I have done with that band, either psychologically in the studio to get them to go in a direction that served their song better. So as a songwriter, I fear that a lot of new people just find it too hard, too frustrating, and they pull the ripcord and they're gone.
You're absolutely right about that. And sometimes if you come back to that song months later or even years later, you go, oh, this was a really good song. Why did I stop working on it?
Right.
It's you didn't have enough perspective. And at that time, maybe you didn't have the skills to fix the problem. I've had taxi members say to me, I'm doing the best I can. This is the best I can write. And I'm still not getting a forward. I'm still not getting what I want. And I go, learn something. You know, go home and listen tonight and learn something, or read my books or whatever, and learn something tonight. And tomorrow, the best you can do will be better than you did today. Yeah. You're not going to stop where you are. I haven't stopped learning about songwriting in my entire life, and I'm still learning. I mean, you're never going to stop learning about it.
If you improve by 1% a week,
imagine.
A 50%, at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Incremental.
And you're absolutely right. So, which brings me to another point I wanted to make, which is that if you don't learn the skill of songcraft, the skills of songcraft, you're stuck writing whatever comes out of you. You know, and we've been talking about that earlier. A lot of times what comes out of you sounds like everything else you ever heard, you know?
Yeah.
So you take what comes out of you. Okay, let's say that's your first rough draft. And if you say, like you were just talking about, oh, I hate it, that's terrible, put it away, and you never do another draft of it because you don't know how, then you don't, that song never gets a chance to come out into the world, ever. And that good idea that you had that got you started, it never happens. So if you learn one songcrafting skill, and let me give you an example of a good songcrafting skill that you need to have. Let's say imagery. Okay, so imagery is something we use in all kinds of writing, all types of writing, and it doesn't just mean visual images. It means anything that helps you imagine the world of the character or the singer or the person they're singing about. So I'm going to use the Taylor Swift hit, Cruel Summer. And it's the statement she's making, the thing she wants you to hear and wants you to know is she's saying to another person, I want you to be with me. I really want you. I want you a lot. I want you so much. I want you. You could say that. I mean, you can just say that over and over and nobody's going to feel anything and people aren't going to be interested in your song and you're not going to be interested in your song. Mm-hmm. So you have to learn to say things in ways that make listeners go, I want to hear that again. I want to hear about how you want that person. How do you want that? What does that feel like? What is that like? Because listeners are basically voyeurs and they want to be on the inside of everything anyway. So what she does is she uses imagery. She has two co-writers on this, Jack Antonoff, who she writes with frequently, and also St. Vincent, the artist St. Vincent. So this is a little different for Taylor Swift. So here's her first verse, her opening verse. See, you know, and this is what grabs people and makes the listeners want to hear more. Fever dream high in the quiet of the night. You know that I caught it. Bad, bad boy, shiny toy with a price. You know that I bought it. And right away you get a glimpse of the singer's, somebody is a woman willing to take risks on a bad boy, and she knows he's a bad boy and she's gonna go for it anyway. So by the first four lines, you know who these people are. You got a pretty good idea. You can see his tats and you can see her going, oh, that, I want that. Then she goes on, killing me slow out the window. I'm always waiting for you to be waiting below. So it's kind of the Romeo and Juliet thing. Mm-hmm. Devils roll the dice, angels roll their eyes. Oh. What doesn't, yeah, isn't that great?
Yeah.
What doesn't kill me makes me want you more. So she took that cliche, and I loved it, of what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Yeah. What doesn't kill me makes me want you more. And I thought that was a great, this is brilliant lyric writing.
Yeah.
It's fun, it's fresh, it's vivid. You can see the people. No, I'm not talking about.
And she could say in four compact lines what a new, just beginning songwriter would take paragraphs to say. And that's one of the major foundational skills of becoming a great songwriter, is how can you say paragraphs in seven word sentences, four of them?
One of the definitions of poetry is saying the most in the fewest possible words. And I think that's a good description of lyrics.
Yeah.
You know, how much can you say? Now, you don't have to draw a picture of the people, because for film and television, if you're doing that, you can just give us an idea of what this feels like. I've got another really short example here. Great. From a song called Rise by Eddie Vedder of mm-hmm. Pearl Jam.
Sure.
He's a great songwriter. Rise, he says, there's just four lines here. This is a song in which he wants to tell you what it feels like to stand up against the odds, to you know, to be strong in the face of adversity. He says, gonna rise up, burning black holes in dark memories. He doesn't say, I'm gonna get rid of old memories, I'm not gonna go there, I'm not gonna think about the things that have happened to me in the past, the paragraph version of that. I'm burning black holes in my memories, in dark memories. Gonna rise up, turn my mistakes into gold. Not just forget my mistakes, not learn from my mistakes, but turn them into gold. This song, Rise, was written for the movie Into the Wild, and it was used in that movie. And he wrote, when you read an interview with him where he talks about writing the songs for Into the Wild, he just wrote and wrote and wrote. And he gave it all to the director to piece his way through it. And this is one of the songs that came out of that. So you can see how he tends to, when he writes in vivid language. He didn't say, I stood up to them. Because stand up is weaker. It says, yeah, this is something I can do. He said, rise up, mm-hmm. like the sun rises. It's a bigger thing. And you may not get to that bigger thing until your second draft. So maybe the first draft said, I stood up. I'm going to stand up. Oh, I'm going to rise up. Ooh, rise. I'm going to rise up. Yeah. And there you go. It feels better and better as you go through it, but it's a process of going through it. And I think that probably he went through that process pretty quickly because he's been writing for so long with Pearl Jam and then writing on his own. To him, he starts it and he goes, not that, but this. And if you don't give your chance to say not that, but this, you never get to the this. And this is such a gorgeous example of
I
it.
I love that suggestion. I find it in my own life. I'm the last set of eyeballs on every taxi listing that goes out the door. And the thing that I do is a little bit of polishing. And one of the things I do is if my staff writes up the listing, it says, you know, major record label is looking for pop R&B songs, I'll change looking for to hunting for. Because mm-hmm. looking for is... Hunting is more active, more intense. Yes. They want
yes,
it more.
I'm going to find it. There's yeah. a goal. There's prey. There's yeah. A, yeah, there's all kinds of stuff. Words with associations, which is exactly what you just said. This word has more as physical, urgent associations, hunting for, mm-hmm. than looking for does. And so just punching up your verbs in a song lyric or in any kind of writing, actually, but punching up your verbs, your action words, makes a difference in how the listener reacts to your song. So I often will see lyrics where it's like the first draft, even though the singer, the songwriter might say, no, this is my last draft. no, this is your first draft, because you haven't gone back and punched up your action words. You don't want to overdo it because it'll start to sound fakey right. and manipulative even sometimes if you go too far, but just a couple of them, hunting for instead of looking for, is enough to grab the attention of the reader or the listener. So when Eddie Vedder says, rise up, that makes your body feel like it's almost rising up. It comes with physical associations, mm-hmm. just like hunting for comes with emotional associations and physical associations. It's writing with associations, those kinds of emotional and physical associations. That's songcraft. And once you know, that's it. That's all you have to know about it, right? Once you have that, then you have to go, well, how do I come up with those? Okay, how did Eddie Vedder come up with that? I kind of hinted at it when I said he's written a lot. Right?
Yeah,
at
this point. Practice yeah, makes perfect.
That click, that little switch in your head goes on, if you can keep it on, which finds those kinds of words. If it stays on, the creativity switch, I call it, if you work every day, this is another thing that beginning songwriters don't do. If you work for maybe 30 minutes a day, and you've said it too, you'll keep that creativity switch on. Don't sit around thinking, I don't have enough time to write. Maybe this weekend I'll have a 3 or 4 hours without something, but of course you won't. But if you just find a half an hour before dinner or after dinner, you know, watch one less half hour of TV or something, you will keep that creativity switch turned on and you'll find those phrases more easily because you're looking for them because you're tuned into that channel and you're like, your antennae are out.
Don't wait for the muse to
don't
show
wait.
Up. Show yeah. her where you're going to be every day at 5:30
exactly.
p.m.
exactly. And keep a list. If something occurs to you and you wake up in the middle of the night, that's the you know, and of course it occurs to you when you're driving the car. But keep your voice memo handy.
Good uses, yeah, for those evil little devices.
Hang on to that stuff. Get a hook book going so that when you're ready to sit down and you do your 30 minutes, the first thing you do is open that book and you say, that, I like that phrase. I'm going to try to write just a verse or a chorus with that phrase right now. And do it. And then put it aside, stop working, and go away. Next day when you come back, pick it up, look at it, and go, yeah, I like that. I'm going to work on that some more. I'll punch up the verbs or the action words, or I'll write a verse to go with it. I think that's my chorus. Having that fresh ears walking away and coming back is actually one of the most important parts of working on any creative project, is getting some distance, then coming back and seeing it as if for the first time. That's extremely important.
Absolutely. I haven't asked you this, I don't believe, on any of the episodes we've done together, but it's really appropriate for this one because it's all about beginning songwriters and them being fearful or not knowing where to start. Yeah. I think a lot of people think that they need to know music theory in order to start being a songwriter. How do you feel about that? Are they right or are they not right?
You don't need to know music theory. I've had a lot of people say, do I need to be able to write notes? Mm-hmm. No, you don't, not for anything. You used to have to do it for the copyright office, but right. not anymore. Fortunately, no. I mean, music theory doesn't hurt, but it doesn't help. I mean, somebody asked me recently, how do you apply the circle of fifths to songwriting? And I just said, don't worry about it, because right now we're not doing that very much. We do a lot of by ear. I think most songwriters do best when working by ear, because you can feel it inside. Yeah. And that's why it's as important to listen as it is to write. We were talking earlier about finding songs and artists that you like to listen to, because you need to listen more, not only to just absorb and imprint how songs sound today, but also to learn. You know, when I say study them, pull them apart, take a look and learn what the chord progression looks like. Today's songs, the chord progressions look pretty repetitive. They will just go around in a circle and round in a circle. And maybe when they change to the pre-chorus or the chorus, they might change the order of the chords, or they might not. They're very repetitive. So something like the circle of fifths right now is going to cause you to overwrite, because you're going to try to use what you know. Some of the hardest people I've ever worked with to teach songwriting, to work with as songwriters, are schooled musicians, because they feel that the schooling in musicianship and music theory that they have hard earned, and you know, the practice and the amount of time that you spend in classrooms learning that, they've earned a lot. But when it comes to songwriting, it's a very different set of skills. And the primary skill when it comes to the music is to make the music support the emotion that the singer wants to get across. And whether that emotion, whether the lyric comes first or the music comes first, they're going to have to work together. And if you start using your rational left brain to take you, you know, write something more complicated and impressive, you're going to lose the emotion that you started with, because instead you're trying to impress others. A lot of musicians feel that pop music is beneath them. You know, school musicians feel that jazz is the only way to go and pop music is too simple, which it is. I mean, pop music is popular music. It's for everybody. And jazz isn't, doesn't seem to be. And so that's something that some musicians have to overcome, and they don't want to, because they spent so many years really earning the knowledge that they have. Doesn't mean you can't write pop songs. Burt Bacharach certainly did it, and Steely Dan certainly did it.
And they incorporated like really high level jazz concepts to pop music with really obtuse lyrics that somehow were instantly sticking in your brain, even though you really didn't understand what the hell they were talking about. It was like over our heads, but still memorable. Wow.
Absolutely. So you can blend jazz and pop. It's tough to do. One of the hardest things, that's why we don't have a lot of people who do it, but it's tough to do, but you can do it. So if you are interested in working in a genre that requires you to know a lot of music theory, which jazz does, then you're going to need to know it. If you want to work in Americana, that doesn't require music theory, because Americana, historically, is the music of the back porch. It's the sitting out with your friends and pals, and you picked up a guitar and you're just starting to play things that you like. I'm reading a book right now called Delta Blues by Ted Goya. And it's amazing. It's gotten me into listening to blues artists I never heard before. A guy named Charlie Patton, Patton, never heard of him. He didn't have that revival in the 60s that other blues players did. I put it on Spotify. Yeah. I went over and I listened, of course, and I was blown away with what he was doing with time, syncopation and interweaving, and just astonishing. Please go to Spotify and listen to Charlie Patton. I thought, this is a man who spent time at Parchman Farm. This is a man who has no music theory at all. Mm. Everything is what he hears. It's the way he hears it and the people he heard it from, and he is doing that. So we don't have to have music theory, and I wouldn't let that stop anyone from writing what you feel and writing what you want to say and express to other people. Then learning songcraft as you do that, the craft of lyric writing, which I was just looking at, and the craft of writing to four chord progressions right now is a songcraft skill you have to have if you're going to get professional about this at all. So it changes over time, but yeah.
A lot of people that are new songwriters come from a poetry background. Mm-hmm. They had the need to express themselves in one form or another, and long form prose, a little too long, a little too complicated. Now you feel like you're writing a book. So poetry, and they probably haven't studied the forms, various forms and rules and writing poetry is like being a jazz musician. It's a lot harder than it looks on its face. Yeah. But, you know, like a 5-year-old go, look, I play jazz, you know, would pick up whatever instrument they could make a sound out of it and just riff on it, and they would call it jazz. Well, somebody who thinks they're writing poetry probably isn't, but they would like it to be a song, because you don't have hit poems, generally speaking, but you have hit songs. So then they fancy themselves as a songwriter. So what would your advice be to somebody who has an emotion, back to that again, they've expressed it in something that is loosely like a poem, and now they would like to set it to music and become a songwriter? What do you do with that?
That's a really good one, and I hadn't written that on my list, and I should have. A poem is not a song lyric.
Right.
There are several reasons why it's not. One is, for example, you have to sing a lyric to a melody, and written on the page, it may not sing at all. It may not have the kind of rhythm that works well with melody, the kinds of consonants that may smash together that you absolutely can't sing one after the other and make any sense. Even more important, poetry now is on the page. We read poetry on the page unless you go to a poetry slam, and those can get pretty close to rap and mm-hmm. lyrics. But if it's on the page, the reader has the chance to read it and then read it over again and read it over again and think about it before they go on to the next line. You can't do that with lyrics. Every line has to be either interesting or reveal something to the listener in that moment. Because if you get them thinking in that moment, they're going to miss the next line and probably the line after that, and then they may not be able to get back in again.
That's a great point.
It unreels in real time.
Yeah.
Songs do. You also can't write something in the second verse that makes it possible to understand the first verse, or even two lines away. You can't write things out of order. You have to write, I'm oversimplifying this, and I don't have an example at my fingertips. I do see it every once in a while where somebody has said something and then the explanation for that thing occurs later in the song. There's no way for people, they can't make the leap, the connection that far apart. And so a lot of times I'll say, well, people won't remember that you said that in your first verse, or you haven't told them that yet. And so they can't feel what you're talking about because they don't have enough information. So verses deliver information, but it has to deliver the information in a certain order. And then your chorus takes off and gives us, this is how I feel about that. Then your next verse can go on and continue the information. But you can't be sure that your listener is going to remember the information they heard in the first verse unless you made sure that they remembered it.
You have referred many times that we've spoken. This may be a course level 201 thing, but I think we should give it over to the 101 people that this show is about or for. And that is that they know backstory that the listener doesn't. So they fill in the blanks with what's already up here in their storyline, because there's an assumption going on and some history and background and familiarity with the whole storyline. So How can you, more succinctly than I just said it, make that into a mistake that new songwriters make and tell them how to avoid it?
That's a really good one. Because not only do you know your backstory and you know what happened and you know how you feel, and you know, and sometimes there's a tendency to simply say, here's all the things that happened to me, or here's the things that I want to talk about, and here's how I feel about it. Not only that, but your family and friends also know. And so when you go play your song for your family and friends, they go, I love that song. Oh, that was your breakup with Harry, wasn't it? And we know how much you loved Harry. And so that's a wonderful song. And so every once in a while, pretty often, you'll hear a song like that, which is making assumptions, as you say, about things that we have no idea about because we are strangers.
And we can't connect because we don't.
There's no way to know. Yeah. So you have to, when you're writing your song, you need to think about what does a stranger need to know? And how do I tell it to them so that I can keep them riveted to me, sitting next to me? If you went up, so what I tell people to do is imagine that you go up to a complete stranger and sit down next to them and begin telling them whatever it is you're telling me in your song. Because that's what you're doing. And it's a complete stranger. And in order for them to become riveted by the story that you're telling them, how would you do that? And not, you know, for them to be, you know, completely, totally bored or think that you're crazy or, you know, but that's what we're doing in our songs is we're writing our personal stories into these songs that are meant to go out to complete strangers and connect with them. And make them feel what I felt. That's the power of songs. When songs are working, they connect strangers. And I don't even know you and I never even meet you. And yet you heard my song and it's the most intimate thing that you could imagine. And I was talking to you about something that maybe happened to you. And that's exactly what you felt. So when people listen to a song that it goes into too much detail about my personal situation that you don't need to know, that's when the industry says to you, really, we don't care about you. And it sounds so cold, but it's true. Strangers don't care about you. They don't know you. They don't want to know you. They don't care about you. So how on earth do we make them care about our songs? We make it about them. This is that thing that you always hear, make it about them. Well, what the heck does that mean? It means that you engage them in what's happening using songcraft, like we were talking about, the words that make them go, what's that? Wow, that's interesting. They're voyeurs. They want to be a fly on the wall. So you've engaged them. So you've made it about them. If you listen to John Mayer's, one of my favorite songs for all kinds of songcraft is Slow Dancing in a Burning Room. He's talking about his breakup with somebody and she's not getting it. And you, as the song goes along, you understand and you hear what he's saying to convince her that this is the last time. This is not a silly little moment. This is not the storm before the calm. This is the deep and dying breath of this love that we've been working on. That's the opening four lines. If that doesn't catch you and get you involved and get you interested in hearing about it, nothing will. And it's not because it's John Mayer in this case. It's because it's a great lyric that makes you want to hear more because really, what kind of moment is that? That's a scary moment. That's a big emotional moment. I'm afraid of those moments. I've had those moments and those emotions. What do you want to say about it that might make me feel better about it? Now I'm engaged. Now I'm involved in something that happened to him and he doesn't even know me. So that's, we relatable. Use songcraft to make it relatable. Yes.
I do something sort of similar. I pay attention to something sort of similar. When I wrote the title for this episode, How to Avoid the Five Mistakes New Songwriters Make, I could have just simply called it Five Common Songwriting Mistakes. But
yes.
It was about new songwriters because I wanted to invite them in particular. And rather than talking about techniques, five songwriting techniques, which would have been an okay subject line, made it about how to avoid the mistakes because none of us want to make a mistake. So, you know, it's somewhat analogous because you have to think about who your audience is and what can I say that makes them go, hey, that's me. It's exactly what you're talking about, relatability in a little higher art form than what I just did.
It's all the same. It's all the same. You know, advertising, promotion, and songwriting, on some level or another, they all try to catch our attention, try to get us involved. I say the three things that you want listeners to do are relate, engage, and participate.
Say that one more time.
Relate, engage, and participate. So relatable means, I understand that. I felt that. I understand what you feel. You feel like my friend telling me something I'm interested in. I'm relating to you. Engaging means getting their brain engaged in visualizing what happened. That was what Cruel Summer did so well. It engaged your brain. It got you seeing the bad, bad boy with a price. And now I can even remember that line because it engaged my mind with a picture, with an image, with an action, something that physical sensation, those kinds of things. And it's similar to participating. Once you get that mental movie running through somebody's head, you get them participating. So, for example, when Chris Stapleton writes, you know, when you broke my heart, it shattered like a rock through a window, I can see that. I can relate to it because, man, that must have hurt. And I can also participate in that. I can hear the shattering glass. It's running in my head. It's making noises. It's getting my body to feel that shock of having a rock come through the window. Even if it's not conscious, it's subconscious. So you try to run the mental movie or the images, get inside their head with the images, and you try to use the physical sensation of things like shattered, rock through a window. You get people to react physically, and then relate, because we can all relate to having our heart broken. So those are some of the ways that we get them to relate, engage, and participate. Is by using the song, kind of song craft, the kind of words that get inside your head with images and physical sensations, and the kinds of situations that people can relate to. Those same kinds of situations are the kinds we see in film and television, because those are common, those are things that happen to people. They may not be common, but the emotions are common. We all understand the emotions, no matter what the crazy situation might be, but we all know what it feels, what fear feels like, or uncertainty, or courage, or facing something that's difficult to face. And that's what you see in TV and film scenes. We can all relate to those. In the same way, we write songs about those same things. It's because those are the things that humans can all relate to, emotional situations.
You've spoken several times about make your second verse the first verse. And I don't know why I cannot remember what the purpose of that is, but I've got to believe that that's somewhere between a 101 level course and a 201 level course. So I'm cheating a little bit and throwing it out for the 101 kids. But why is that, that people often write their second verse first? Is that how it goes?
Not into your song yet in your first verse. You don't yet have, a lot of times people write linearly. We write a first verse and then we write the chorus and then we write the second verse. And I'm often so the second verse is where you're really into it. Mm-hmm. Now I got it. I got my verse. I know what my payoff line is. I know what I'm singing about. Now I'm into it. Okay.
So do you move the second verse up to the pole position and throw the first verse out and then write a new second verse? Or do you take the first verse and supplant it where the second verse was?
It depends on what you wrote in your first verse. So a lot of times what we write in the first verse is the history. I met you on Monday. We fell in love on Tuesday. We got married on Wednesday. A lot of times when I first met you, I fell in love the moment I saw you. But you didn't want me around at all. A lot of times that's your first verse. And because you're getting into it, and we're storytellers. Most songwriters are storytellers. And so we start at the beginning of the story, naturally. But that's not what we want to do with the song. When the listener hears the song, you want to drop them right into the middle of it. And so, you know, you just start, usually your second verse is where you get to the meat, the heart of the situation. I wish you would unpack your suitcase and unclench your fists. you know, and because I don't want any more of this. You just make that your first line.
Right. It tells you, it gives you the backstory in a line.
Yeah, you get the whole situation in a line. I wish you would unpack your suitcase and unclench your fists. I've had so much of that. I've had too much of this. That gives you the backstory, right? This has been happening for a while. But you may have started that with, tonight we had a fight and I just walked out and you stayed and you're not letting me in. The door's locked and I can't get in. I wish, you know, and then you sing a chorus and then you don't get to the actual emotion of it till the second verse. That's a situation in which you would move that second verse up to the first verse so that the very first line is the one that gets the listener's attention and drops them into the middle of the emotional situation. Okay. So it's probably the same thing that John Mayer was doing. Those are the first four lines of Slow Dancing in a Burning Room. I just said them, and now I have to get it. This is not the calm. This is not the storm before the calm. Yeah, this is not a silly little moment. That's his opening line. What's not a silly little moment? I'll bet that was originally verse two. Look, this isn't a silly little moment. This I've been telling you, this is it. You're not believing me. This isn't a silly little moment. It's not the storm before the calm. I love how he flips that. Not the storm before the calm. This is the dying breath of the love that we've been working on. This is what a lot of beginning songwriters would make their second verse, and the first verse would be, we had this fight tonight.
Right.
So what we want to do is say to the list is give the listeners that subject line you were talking about, the one that makes you go, I want to hear this. Avoid those five mistakes, right? Mm-hmm. And we haven't told them what the five mistakes are that they should avoid yet. The mistake you make is telling them the five mistakes first and then saying, avoid those.
Right. Right. So,
right. You want to get the interesting, intriguing stuff up front. So when a lot of times what I do is look at the first four lines of a song when I'm giving feedback on songs, one of those things I'd love to do is look at those first lines. I don't have the Cruel Summer one in front of me, but that's another example when she says, oh, fever dream high on a summer's in the quiet of the night. Fever dream high in the quiet of the night. I want to know what's happening. Mm-hmm. What's a fever dream high feel like, and why have you got one? And I want to know all about it. It's a beautiful opening line, and in fact, all four lines really drag you right into the middle of this. And that's good songwriting that anybody can do. Somebody who's new may not think of those words first. The words may come on the second draft, but the first draft is, oh yeah, that feeling. That feeling of just being so, having such a crush on somebody on a hot summer night and summer love. Yeah. And you write that down. You come back later and you say, okay, fever. It's like having, you know, fever, dreaming of somebody. Yeah, fever dream. And you can like put that together when you come back for your second draft. But don't neglect to write down what it is you wanted to say. So that brings me to another
Mistake that people should avoid.
Avoid that I wanted to bring up, which is when you write linearly, when you start with line one and you write straight through, those first lines probably are inspired. And you just, so you write down what your inspiration gives you, and they're really good, those lines. Yeah, maybe you got fever dream high in the quiet of the night. Maybe that's your inspiration gave you that. I love that. And then you keep writing the second line. And then the third line is still talking about the dream you had. And the fourth dream is, and I'm going to reach for it. And all of a sudden you're writing some song about reaching for your dream or something. And maybe that's not what you intended to write about when you started, but you didn't stop long enough to ask your inspiration what it meant. So I'm going to really recommend that when your inspiration gives you four lines, because sometimes it does, that before you go any further, you stop and look at what your inspiration has given you. What am I writing about? What is this song about? And then sketch out the song, right? So you sketch, oh, okay, here's my inspiration. This is what it's saying in verse one. Okay, so that means that my chorus is probably gonna say, this is how I feel about that. okay, so this is how I feel about it. I'm upset by that, or I love that. It feels really, really good, but I also know it's dangerous. Okay, that's my chorus. Then the next verse, what am I going to say in the second verse? I'm going to say, this is what I like. At night, I run out and unlock the door, and I go out and we do something. We go to the bars, and I'm not supposed to be out with you, but I am. And we go to the bars, and on the way back in the taxi, I'm crying because you said you didn't want to see me anymore. That's actually the second verse of that song. And then you go to the chorus again, dangerous, I'm in love, fever dream, I'm in love, but it's dangerous. I just got hurt. I got that. Okay, now you know where your song's gonna go. You know, the first verse, the second verse, and the chorus. You may need a bridge or not, but that'll be enough to get you going. Then you can go back and you've got a raw sketch that says, here's what I'm gonna say in my chorus. I don't yet know how I'm gonna say it, but I'm going to start sketching out ideas for that.
Some of the best advice you've ever given in the last 2 minutes. That's great advice, because it's so easy to go off the reservation and just go wherever the muse takes you. And before you know it, you've got something that's meandering more than the path, you know, at the Queen's Castle. I mean, it's just, you have no idea what the song is about anymore, because you got an inspiration here and went, ooh, and that gave you another inspiration. You're right. It's like wireframing the homepage of a website.
Yes.
What you want to do, and then fill in the blanks to get there.
Yes, because your inspiration is not linear. Your inspiration is like a dream, and it goes through to different places whenever it feels like. I had a dream last night about a toddler, and I saved him lifted him out of the street and ran back to my house with him. And then that changed to, driving my car, but I couldn't find the brake. And then it changed to, you know, something else. That's inspiration. It all happens on a subconscious level. You don't know where it comes from. And you don't know what triggered that. Could be anything triggered, any one of those four or five things that triggered those ideas. And so you end up with four or five songs.
Right.
And I see that all the time. People bring me their songs and they got four or five songs in there. And so we just pull them apart and they end up with four or five really good songs. And each one of them can be sketched out, but they can't go together. Because in songwriting, more is not more. In songwriting, less is more.
Yeah.
You have to have less, and it needs to be highly focused and go deep into that in order to take the listener there with you.
Just
if you're talking about, they can't follow you otherwise.
I've always said, I learned this as a producer. I was probably told this by one of the great people that mentored me back in the day, but just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Correct. Yes. Please. Okay. There's so many times when that's applicable. Yes. I love that. Yeah. And so inspiration will take you where it wants to go. I often describe inspiration as a nuclear puppy, because it's got a boundless energy, endless energy, but it goes everywhere it wants to go. And you can put a little light leash on it. You can't put too much of a leash, but you can pull it back in. It's in my books, this whole thing about the nuclear puppy.
That's a great name for a band.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
Somebody's done it.
Nuclear puppies. I love it.
Snarky puppy, but okay. I don't know if they've done nuclear yet.
I'm going to pop up the frame with your book again, just to remind people that might have tuned in late that Robin, this was Robin's first book. It's a bestseller. It's become an industry standard. I cannot tell you, and I am a little biased because I am the publisher of this book, and just know that I do make a couple bucks if you buy one. But I always say to people, I've been saying this for as long as this book has been published, if you buy it and you don't think it was worth more than what you paid for it, send it back to me in resellable condition. I will refund your money. Only one person has ever done that. So many of our successful taxi members have read this book. Just, you know what? Don't take my word for it. Go online, go to Amazon, read the reviews, look inside the book, see what the chapters are, read a few pages, and what you'll find is kind of like having Robin sitting right next to you. So every time you go, ooh, what should I do here? You can find it in the book. You don't have to read this book cover to cover. It's not that kind of book. It's almost like having a songwriting therapist sitting next to you that's willing to take any question you will throw at her as they come up, rather than reading a book about psychology. So there you go. Just a little plug for something that I wholeheartedly believe in And now back to our regular programming.
And Amazon's having a little sale now. It's 12% off. So
wow. Valentine's Day. Buy it for your honey before clock strikes midnight.
And the whole thing I was talking about, sketching a song, that's in there. I mean, a lot of this stuff is in there. There's only a limited amount of songcraft that you have to learn. I mean, it's not rocket science and it doesn't go on forever. But as songs evolve, you can continue to learn fresh things, but they all come back to the same songcraft. It's just different ways of using it.
Before we started, you said, don't forget that, bring it up. So I'm going to bring it up, which is every melody I would write would sound like it was inspired by the music I fell in love with when I was 15 to 20 years old. And I mentioned to you that there's software out there now, which is clearly AI-driven software that creates melodies. So you can literally, it's text-driven prompts. And I can't remember the name, but I tried it like 6 weeks ago. I downloaded the free version, played with it for an hour, and then never opened it again. But it was kind of cool because you could say, write me a sad melody for a broken-hearted love song. And it would come up with something. Now, I'm not one of these people who's encyclopedic about people's melodies. So maybe it was too close to something. Maybe it wasn't. But then you could say, it's not sad enough. And it would give you a variation, that melody that was, in fact, sadder. It sounded manufactured. It's not there yet.
Yeah.
But how do you feel about new songwriters? What mistakes do they make when starting to write melodies? And do you think that AI could be a tool for them, or is it not fully baked yet?
It's not fully baked by any means, and who knows what will happen there. But I did check it out not too long ago, and I was glad to hear that you had checked it out. I think the issue with it and the way to use it, and it's the way I used to use Band in a Box. It's really bad. It used to be really bad. Band in a Box has gotten better. I don't want to slam Band in a Box.
No, I heard something done with Band in the Box about a month ago, and I was like, really? You did that?
Yeah.
Much better. So yay for them.
Anything that gives you an idea for a melody or an idea for a lyric, AI for lyrics, which is also it's really pretty bad. But what you get to do then is say, well, not that. You know, I don't like that's terrible, but... if I did it like this, I would like that. In other words, it tells you what you don't want, and it gives you a springboard to what you do want. So I have used Band in a Box for basic chords and melody, and then said, no, throw that out, but I'll keep this little bit right here, and I'll start my song with that little bit, and I might keep that little bit there, and maybe this, and that gave me an idea. It's like having a collaborator that doesn't mind if you tell them that they stink, right?
That's a great analogy.
Yeah. And you get to. And that makes you feel better, too, is that I like this, but I don't like any of that. AI for lyrics, it's just stringing lines together. It's real lyrics take so much human connection with your own heart and your own mind and all of your experience and all of that. Real lyrics, you can feel when a human is saying it. I can't say I could always recognize an AI generated thing, but I do have clients and students who are using some AI to prompt new ideas when they're stuck. And that seems to work okay. The question of copyright is still an issue. The Copyright Office has said, if it is substantially changed by a human, then we will copyright it. But what does substantially mean? You know, so now we're in that gray area again. So with melody, I would say if it prompts you to write, gives you an idea for an opening line, then I would say follow that up by repeating that line, which we often do. Do it again. Then go away, write something you like in a couple of short phrases. Then come back to something that kind of sounds like the first one. In other words, apply your songcraft for melody structure to the line that it gave you. And you might end up liking it. If you don't, throw it out and start over again. So I'm not opposed to prompts like that.
Yeah.
But the idea that at this point that it's going to write something fresh or original or anything else, at this point it's not going to. I have no idea where it's going to end up.
I found a great use for AI, a real live actual great use for AI.
What?
In the film and TV music world, having a great title for your piece of music is something you must have, because it gives video editors who are plopping music into shows, let's say they're working on a scene where a 21-year-old surfer kid has, you know, slept on the beach to wake up and get the perfect wave as soon as the sun comes up. And so they need a piece of surf music for the movie. And the editor's saying that he's not interested in Mary's Song or I Love You Dearly or Fast Car, seems to be in our consciousness lately. Mm-hmm. They're going to notice a song that's called something like Catch the Big One or Surf's Up. I mean, those are corny and obvious, but they do tell you that that piece of music on a list of 10,000 things in an electronic bucket is, in fact, has something to do with surfing.
So, in the genre that you want, it's going to be probably surf music.
Yeah. So you want the editor to know that that thing they're looking at is surf music. So I did an entire episode of Taxi TV where I took taxi listings to get the type of music that was being searched for. I did it for songs. I did it for instrumentals. And I put prompts into ChatGPT. And I would say 70% or greater that what I got back was very usable and very good for titles, suggestions. And for the ones that were just a little corny or not that good, they often prompted me to create something better. So that's it's one of two really good uses I've found for AI so far.
It's got short phrases. I mean, definitely can do short phrases. That's a great idea for generating ideas, for generating titles you might want to use. I often will just turn on Young and the Restless or something and listen to some actor emoting, you know, and I'll start writing down phrases because they're really, really good phrases. For song titles, if you're interested in writing something with an emotional relationship.
Those are professional writers that write every day. If you're going to steal from the best, and that's it's not stealing if you don't actually take the thing, but if you're using it as a springboard, they do that too.
Let's see.
We got one more.
Let me see.
Minutes.
Okay. Thinking you don't have enough talent. Okay. So I know at some point almost every song I ever wrote, at some point I sat there and said, I have no talent. Why am I doing this? I can't do this. I don't know how to do this. I shouldn't be doing this. It's something that hits every new songwriter and even songwriters who have been doing it for a long, long time. Because being creative, you don't know what comes next. You have no control over what comes next. And you don't know if you'll be able to do it again. And you get in the middle of something and maybe you hit something, a snag, and you can't work your way out of it. And you sit there and go, I don't know if I'll ever come up with another original idea. it's the way that it works. It's the way creativity works. So I like to say to people, talent is not something that's reserved for the few. Talent is something, what talent means is simply the ability to master something faster than others. So when somebody who has talent picks up a violin and learns how to play it in a relatively short time, because violin's really hard to play, somebody else like me would pick up a violin and I'd probably never be able to play it because it would take me far longer than I feel like investing in that. But the person who has talent doesn't really recognize that they were able to capture that particular skill, but they may not be able to capture another one. And if they're expecting to do that, they really get into trouble. So songwriting takes a lot of different aspects of talent. You have a talent for lyrics, or you have a talent for melody, or you have a talent for playing an instrument. You may not have all of those. It's very rare the person who has a talent for all of those things. And so if you are thinking, I don't have the talent, stop, go learn some more stuff, and then come back and have another go at the song. Because it's probably not a lack of talent. In fact, I'm sure it's not a lack of talent. It's a lack of knowledge. And knowledge, we can handle that. We can control our knowledge. We can take in knowledge. We know where to look. We have resources. We can put things together so that we can solve a problem. But if what we do is look at a problem and say, I have no talent, you can't solve the problem. And so I think that it's important to never say, I have no talent, because it's simply irrelevant. to what you're doing.
I've got a great story that backs that up. A Katy Perry story. For those of you who don't know, Katy Perry was one of our screeners at Taxi. She'd been signed to a record deal, and the record label dropped her. It wasn't the record that they thought she should make as an artist, and they dropped her like a hot potato. And she was broke as broke could be. She called me one day, years after she worked here, to say, I just want to say thank you again and let you know that I was getting eviction notices on my apartment. My car was repossessed. I had to rent a wreck every time I drove out to Taxi to screen music. After she became famous, when her first record hit, she was interviewed by Billboard, and she was talking about, I used to be an A&R person at this company called Taxi, and basically she said, who was I to be telling other people what was right or wrong with their music? Because she saw herself as being talentless. About 5, 6, 7 years after that, out of the blue one day, she called me up. And I still have her in my phone as not Katy Perry, but as her real name. And it showed up, and I thought, how could that be? I thought for sure she would have changed her phone number, but I answered it and went, Katie? And she went, Michael? And we had this really nice, like, 5-minute conversation. And she said, I just want to say thank you again, because I learned so much by helping other people realize what was lacking in what they were doing, that I realized a lot of that stuff was lacking in what I was doing. So
wow,
there you go.
That's amazing. Yeah, when you've lost your record deal, you have every right to feel like you have no talent.
Yeah.
It's going to do that to you. And you have to get up and keep going. You can't let that stop you. So find something to do that is different from what you have been doing. Look for solutions to problems. Don't let it stop you. For sure, don't let your own mind stop you, your own emotions stop you from writing. Because you'll never know what you missed. It's so important.
Well, I think that you gave our viewers more than 5 mistakes that new songwriters make, and I thank you for the work that you put into this. It was great. I mean, honestly, I would tell you this off camera, but out of all the shows we've done together, this may be my favorite. You gave out a lot of great stuff today. I hope that the folks in the chat room and watching the show when it airs live enjoy it as much as I did hanging out with you today. You're an all-star. Ever cease to amaze me. And I've known you, I don't know, 15 or more years. And we've had many of these conversations. I always learn something. So thank you for that. And with that, I'm going to show the book cover one more time, just because I can. There it is. Shortcuts to Hit Songwriting. Pick it up at Amazon. You can also get an ebook version that is literally 3 times the size of this one for about the same price. And it's, level 1, level 2, and level 3. So for those of you who are level 1 and watching this show today, there's that advantage in that you can pick up level 1 as kind of a standalone thing within this set of 3. So there you go. Or people who are more advanced could buy level 3. Just saying. Robin, thank you as always. And thank you guys for watching. I will see you soon on another exciting episode of Taxi TV Live. Bye-bye, you guys.